Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, helping book lovers take full advantage of the ebook revolution. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 253 on June 7th, 2013. Greetings from downtown Denver, Colorado. It's good to be back after nearly a month of travels in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Maine, and New York City. And at this point, Book Expo America seems like it was a month ago, even though it was just last week that I was roaming the vast Javits Convention Center and meeting people doing exciting things in the book industry. The interview for this week's show is one that I recorded at Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing and CreateSpace booth. They had a shared booth there at the show. And the interview is with the vice president in charge of both of those operations, Nader Kabbani. He is an optimistic promoter of book reading who believes that the various ways Amazon makes reading convenient, including the Audible.com subsidiary, whose booth was right next to the other two, mean that the book is well positioned against video games and other competing uses of our time.
I think audience will have no excuse to stop reading or listening. The book keeps following them, whether they're reading it or they're in a bus and listening to it.
In news, I will check in with some tidbits from the Apple ebook price fixing trial, which is going on in New York City, and the return of the Kindle DX, the fate of the Nook, and the opening of the biggest Kindle market in the world. For the tech tip, I'm going to sing the praises of the new update for the Kindle for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch platforms. And in content, I'll pass along some of the reading ideas that I picked up last week at BEA. First up in news, let's talk about the price-fixing trial that Apple is engaged in now, Judge Denise Coate in New York City. There's all kinds of coverage on this, and one thing I've noticed is that people, depending on if you're for Apple or against Apple or for Amazon or against Amazon, you can see different coverage. I won't say slanted, but sort of written from the point of view of one or the other. It seems to me that the New York Times coverage generally puts Apple in the best light and Amazon in the worst light, and you can find different shadings in other sources. There is some good journalistic objective coverage too, and I'll have some links to some stories and paid content and elsewhere. But I happen across an item that I found on Reddit, and it's given me the best understanding of what this trial is about, and I want to share some parts of it with you. It was posted 4 days ago by someone whose handle on Reddit is Competition Rules, competition then R-O-O-L. Z, and it's been very much praised on Reddit. Got 2,625 points. People give points if they think something is good. He introduces it, or she, I guess, it's not clear if it's a man or a woman, saying that they are a longtime lurker, first-time poster, and I am an antitrust lawyer, among other things, and have followed this case closely because it is interesting. Points that this commenter made that I hadn't been clear about include the fact that really the essence of the price fixing is among the publishers, and it involves agreements that they made, or it's charges that they made on a horizontal level because they are peers in the book business. And because that's so clearly it's described as the supreme evil, apparently, in the antitrust laws, and it's the very most illegal thing that competitors can do. So if the Justice Department and the private plaintiffs can demonstrate that publishers agreed to put an agreement in place keeping prices higher than the $9.99 that Amazon was selling new releases and bestsellers at, this commenter writes, the case is over and the publishers lose. So the publishers, when caught, are up the creek and they all settle. So that explains why the publishers settled, according to this take, is that the government pretty much had the goods on them, that they were discussing how to keep the prices higher, and were trying to get to a model, the agency model, that would enable them to enforce higher prices. Apple's role is different, he points out, because Apple doesn't compete with the publishers, and so the charge is that Apple essentially made this conspiracy to fix prices possible for its own reasons. It didn't like Amazon selling books at $9.99 because it was going to reduce the amount of money that Apple would make on the iPad and the selling ebooks on the iPad. It's maybe a little harder to prove that Apple played this hub and spokes kind of a role, making it possible for the publishers to get to the agreement. But it does make some sense, because if these five publishers all wanted to go to a higher price, it's a difficult thing to do, because if any one of them holds out or doesn't agree to it, they get an advantage because they're selling their ebooks are selling at a lower price than the price that's fixed. So it's very tricky to get one of these horizontal agreements in place, and apparently the charge is that Apple really made that possible. Another point that's made clear here is that the most favored nations clause, which you hear a lot of, that was part of these contracts. This writer says this case really is not about those. They existed in the agreements, sure, and they were bad and likely an enforcement mechanism, but the wrongdoing was the agreement on price. There's a good conclusion to this. He included as an edit, saying, "All of the above is based on allegations, not proof. Nothing will be proven until the trial is over. And if the government can't prove what they claim is true, they will lose. They might lose no matter what. Trials are scary, man." It's written, I think it sounds as if that's written by someone who knows. There is a really extensive list of comments to this. You can tell a lot of people had the same reaction I did, that this is a very valuable and kind of dispassionate description of the law that's at issue here in this trial. It just goes on and on and on. And the original poster comes back in with some observations in response to the comments. Way down in those comments, there was something else that I didn't understand completely, and that's this issue of predatory pricing. And I've heard that, I think I heard it at BEA a couple of times, and this idea that Amazon, by selling bestsellers and new releases at $9.99, which I think in most cases was below the price that they were paying, the wholesale price, that this was predatory pricing and that was illegal, and that term predatory pricing is sort of thrown around pretty loosely. And this writer explains it, saying predatory pricing is a very difficult thing to prove. You have to prove not just below cost pricing, but also a dangerous probability that the predator will be able to drive out competition, raise prices, and then later recoup the losses from its below cost pricing through supra competitive prices. The DOJ looked at that allegation against Amazon and determined that in the dynamic ebook market, there was no reason to believe that Amazon's pricing strategy would have the effect of foreclosing competition in the ebook market to a degree sufficient to enable Amazon to independently raise prices down the road. And then later they have a large market share, talking of Amazon, no question, but that's not the end of the analysis. For there to be a valid claim for predatory pricing, Amazon would have to have the ability to drive everyone else out of business and then to jack up prices super high and keep them there for a long time. Even if Amazon did have the ability to drive all the other ebook retailers out of business, which seems unlikely, they could never recoup their losses by jacking prices up again, because all that would happen in that instance is that other retailers would come back into the market to take advantage of the new high prices. And apparently this predatory pricing, there hasn't been a case brought in 20 years or so, this writer says, and the private plaintiffs generally don't bother either. The explanation is as follows. This is because there are hardly any circumstances in which you can argue lower prices are actually harmful to competition or consumers. So I think we can lay that one to rest, the idea that Amazon was engaging in predatory pricing, at least as it's understood in antitrust law. At another point, he says the decision to settle is made pretty dispassionately by the publishers based on, the chances of winning the suit and the cost of it. When I read this description of the antitrust aspects of it, it makes me understand why they all settled. They clearly, there was no love lost toward Amazon, and so the decision was made on probably a pretty rational basis. I'll have a link to this in the show notes, and I think you'll find it useful. Russ Grandinetti, who I spoke with at BEA, was testified, I think he testified on Thursday, and it got into some of the period when the publishers were forcing Amazon to go to agency pricing and reliving that. And I could imagine Grandinetti in the chair getting worked over by Apple's attorney, who clearly looks like a pretty skillful trial attorney. And according to the accounts, he held up pretty well, particularly compared with one poor chap from Google who was picked apart pretty mercilessly, to the point where the judge at the end said that they were going to end at 5 o'clock so that this guy could begin to have a good day. So Grandinetti's testimony at least wasn't described in those kinds of terms compared with the Google witness. I think the trial goes on another 2 weeks or so, plenty more testimony, and who knows, maybe some surprises. But I think what the Reddit commentator pointed out, that trials are scary things. There's really no telling what this judge is going to decide. And I assume that there can be appeals, so it may be a while before this part of the story comes to a conclusion. Next in news, the Kindle DX is back. I don't know how many of you had one of those. That was the large e-ink Kindle that had, a 10-inch screen. I had one, and then they updated it, so I had a second one. It had been discontinued, I think, back in October, but now it's back available at Amazon, showing up just as a regular product at a lower price. The price is now $299, and that's a discount of $80 from the original price. The DX was part of an initiative aimed primarily at the education market, universities, and then that ran afoul of a lawsuit from the National Federation for the Blind, and I think just a sense that it was a little bit cumbersome to use. I remember that keyboard was all crammed together, and it felt like little chiclets that you had to try to use. But I know some people just are still using the DX, and it's a nice, great big screen of e-ink, so there are some circumstances when it could be useful. So I guess if you have an old one and you'd like to get a new one as a backup, this would be a good time to jump in. I think it's been available now for several weeks, so if they just had a few left over that they were trying to get rid of, it seems like it's maybe more of a supply than that. The Kindle keyboard, I've seen some reports it's not available except from third parties, so that one looks like maybe it is finally running its course, and there may be a version of the Kindle that has a physical keyboard. If there's new models in the fall, we'll just have to see. But at this point, the venerable Kindle keyboard looks like it's fading into history as well. Turning to the Nook, I was surprised at BEA how a few times in talking to people, the possibility that the Nook platform just wasn't going to make it would come up. I've always thought of the Nook as the number two e-reader platform with about 20% of the market, and maybe that's falling now. But there was an item that I saw this week, which you read these little clues as to what's ahead, and apparently the Nook app that enables you to read Nook titles on a computer, there's one for the PC and one for the Mac, is no longer available. It's not listed among the applications for the Nook. I tried opening a link that someone had posted, and when I did, the application just didn't function. When I entered my Nook username and password, I couldn't get to my library or see anything. I don't think most people probably use their computers for reading books either on the Kindle or the Nook platform or Kobo or the others, but when you see the possibilities narrowed like that, it's just a sign of, I think, not as robust a support for the platform as you certainly see on the Kindle, and that's something that, you know, is probably of concern. Now, on the other side of things, Nook introduced some short long-form reading, if you can call it that, similar to the Kindle Singles this week, so they've got an area of the store that is going to be moving in that direction. So that's, you know, that's probably a sign of life. But I personally think probably the Nook's days are numbered, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when if that actually comes about, it'd be another big transition in the whole ebook ecosystem. Today, you can buy a Kindle Paperwhite or a Kindle HD 7-inch in China. This has been in the works for a while, but the site went live, and that's a big, big move for Amazon in terms of making the every book available anywhere in the world, as is their mission. Finally, there was an item that showed up in a couple of places that was intriguing because it's something I've always hoped would happen. There's a blog here called slog.thestranger.com, and the title is Amazon Trying to Reach Out to Independent Booksellers? And this there's an independent bookseller in Los Angeles, Skylight Books, posted an anecdote on Wednesday, it might have been last week, saying that the person got a phone call from a representative of Amazon, apparently, who was given the task of reaching out to independent bookstores in order to build a relationship with the indies in order to partner with us in a program to sell Kindles in our store. And this poster from the independent bookstore says, "Yeah, really so." In my most incredulous voice, I asked him if he was serious and stated flatly that we wouldn't be interested. So no response from Amazon on whether this is actually happening, but I've always thought that, you know, some independent bookstore that was willing to look forward rather than backward in terms of Amazon's role in the industry, that there could be a very interesting possibility for selling Kindles and even more importantly, Kindle books in independent bookstores. A lot of us who love books, I think, have felt conflicted about the transition from not being able to go to the tattered cover of the Harvard bookstore and buy a book. But I think that if there was a way to have these bookstores get credit for a sale, I might walk down the street and get on the Wi-Fi there and order some books if it would do them some good, and just have a chance to be there and not have to be furtive about whether or not I was toting a Kindle with me. So, interesting little tidbit leaking out here, and I'll keep it. If you see anything about this, please let me know. If you hear from your independent bookstore that they've been contacted by Amazon, and I'll try to reach out to some of my contacts at the company to see if this is going to be rolling out in any kind of a more official way. If you have any thoughts on this or any news, please send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. For the tech tip, I want to talk about the iOS 3.8 update, which was released this week for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch. This is an update for the Kindle app, and it's significant, I think, mainly because it enables multi-page highlights in a way similar to what we're used to on the e-ink Kindles, the Paperwhite and the basic Kindle. If you're doing a highlight on the iPad, you start on one page, and then if you get all the way down to the lower right corner, it hops over to the next page, and then you just decide where you want the highlight to end once you've done that. I think this is pretty handy, and it's significant, I think, because it's something you can do on the iOS app that you can't do on the Kindle Fire. I tried to just to make sure that they haven't snuck an update in where it's possible. So you see Amazon giving a feature to the iOS app that it doesn't even have in the native app on the Kindle Fire, which I think these operations, Otis Chandler said, you know, there's thousands of people working on the Kindle platform at Amazon now, so they probably each work in their area, and when it's time to update the iOS app, I don't think they have somebody saying, wait, you can't do that because the Fire isn't ready for it. They proceed on their own, and I think that's a good thing. That means that it's sort of like a legal seafood in Boston. When the food is ready, whichever waiter is available brings it to your table fast and not necessarily your own waiter. With these various ways of reading Kindle content, Amazon puts them out when they're ready, and they get to us as fast as we can, no matter what the platform. to introduce this week's interview, which I recorded on Thursday of last week at Book Expo America, I want to play some of a piano puzzle written by Johann Sebastian Bach titled Invention Number 8. And the reason is that the pianist is my guest, Nader Kabbani, an Amazon vice president who told me that he loves to solve problems. That's why he spent 5 months learning this piece, which he explained to me at a party hosted by Goodreads, moves the theme back and forth independently between the two hands before reaching a resolution at the end. As a member of the original Kindle team, Kabbani faced problems of a different sort, including how to keep up with the overwhelming demand for the new product when the first Kindle launched in November of 2007. He was, I think, in charge of all the supply chain at that point, so it had to be a crazy period. So let's listen to a bit how he solved his Bach problem. That was the audio from a YouTube video of Nader playing the piece, and I'll have a link to it at thekindlechronicles.com. Nader Kabbani has been with Amazon for 8 years and now holds the new title of Vice President for Independent Publishing, combining responsibility for Kindle Direct Publishing, KDP, and CreateSpace, Amazon's print-on-demand service. He was born in Jordan and immigrated to the U.S. when he was 18 years old. At Texas A&M, he earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1986 and a master's degree in operations research in 1988. As I said, I interviewed him at the booth at BEA, and I began by asking him how the addition of Goodreads might benefit authors who are using KDP and CreateSpace.
I think it's very early to tell. We love what they're doing for readers. We love what they're doing for authors. One mental model we're thinking of is to find out what are authors doing before they publish, and how can we collaborate on the features that are helping authors in the stage of getting their book written, so pre-publishing, and then what are the services and offerings that we could collaborate on post-publishing. And I think it's very early to tell. I think they're doing a fantastic job, and we would rather them continue to do what they're doing best. And when it makes sense, we find collaboration opportunities.
You were on the early Kindle team as, and it was called something else then.
KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, had an earlier name called Digital Text Platform.
That's right.
I don't know why, but it was incubated in the early days of Kindle.
Because when Kindle was launched in 2007, the whatever it was called then was all ready to go.
Correct. In fact, my job was to enable this channel before Kindle launched, and to be able to satisfy our vision, Jeff Bezos' vision, of every book that is ever published in any channel. We knew that negotiating content from the top publishers is absolutely essential for the top titles, but we needed to get to the tail. And I have been involved in a similar initiative to do the self-publishing for blogs, and I saw the opportunity to be quite massive, in the sense that we had worked for 6 months to ingest 1,000 blogs, and in 1 week when we opened the self-service blog, we got 6,000. So I said, this is the future. And DTP, or KDP in the early inception, was born. It enabled us to launch with 87,000 titles for Kindle when we announced it.
How many independent titles did you have, or self-published titles at the start? Do you remember?
I can't disclose the split between managed and indie, but we continue to work very closely together. In fact, many of our customers now are evolving to be publishers.
Yeah.
And agents, and we love that because they are seeing huge value of keeping control of their metadata, and of course the 70% is a very nice incentive to split the royalty with their authors.
So what can you say to describe the growth since the launch in 2007, maybe from the author side? How many authors you have, how many titles you have, or whatever you can disclose just to show that it's getting very big?
It is absolutely big, and we love it, and it's global. And we are very proud. We are creating an opportunity for authors to make writing as their profession, which I think it's a very special times in history where it's the best time for writers, the best time for readers. So I could see that pattern continues. Many authors are quitting their side jobs and focusing only on writing. And we are very proud to see that seven of them have reached the Kindle Million Club. Amanda Hawking, Barbara Freethy, CJ Lyons. Some of them are already setting up their own booth and identifying themselves as the indie top authors. I'm very, very proud of that. It's been also a huge win for readers. They get selection, very broad selection. The total Kindle selection is 1.8 million. They also get it at very low prices, which are affordable for digital content. I think the number is around 900,000 of the books in the catalog are $4.99 or less. So we can thank KDP for enabling that broad selection at affordable prices. And the third part, which I think is very surprising to us, was they're not just a broad selection, they're also high quality selection. In fact, KDP represents between 25 and 30% of the top 100 books sold on .com, and that number is even bigger in other geographies.
Sometimes I hear people criticize this movement by saying it's just a few people that make it big in self-publishing digital. It's Amanda Hawking, you hear the same people, Authors Guild people that are sort of pressing against the wave for whatever reason. What could you say to indicate that it's not just a few people that are able to make a living this way, that it's a broader movement than just the people that make the headlines?
Good question. I think making it big may not be the objective of many authors. They may be very happy to get their word out and share it with their fans and niche audience. So I really don't want to make financial is the only motivation. Many people just have a passion for writing. In fact, the top 10 list of things that people want to do before they die, that bucket list, in every geography I check, writing a book is number three, or between one, two, three. Sometimes running a marathon, sometimes having exotic travel, planting a tree in Brazil. So I think there's a book in all of us, and we're making that available. Of course, if you have written a great novel and you have written great content and you've invested a lot of time to make that perfect from the metadata and the content, you should be rewarded for it. And we're very happy that people are getting directly their benefit from 70% royalty, full control. And I'm just very proud to see how the seven that are Kindle Million Club are teaching the others. In fact, you see the buttons that they're sharing saying, let me tell you how I made my first million in Kindle. And that's really the movement that I'm very proud of, is that they're teaching others about their profession. And when you talk to these authors, they're not afraid to share their best practices. It's not a competition. There's enough to make everybody happy. And we're very proud of that.
Why do you think there isn't a competition? Because I think of authors as being fairly competitive with each other.
I think they write different genres. They're not all exactly the same. I think there's enough audience to appreciate their work. There's also a very healthy competition, but at the end of the day, it's up to the author to really market their book and get them discovered. And of course, they will do things that will make them stand out compared to their peers. But they're not hiding any best practices of how to be successful.
Now, from the point of view of everyone has a book in them, and yeah, I can see your dream that to help that happen.
You need to write your book.
I have. I have a few up. Yeah. But to make it easy is certainly a big goal. And the fact that as head of independent publishing, you're over CreateSpace and Kindle Direct KDP, it would be great someday if I have my manuscript. It's in Word. I've got some pictures. I hit a button. And it just goes to both CreateSpace and KDP. I don't have to do it separately. Is that a reasonable dream to have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to have that. In fact, organizing it under the same kind of leadership is one step. I must say that there's a lot of steps that we've already done to integrate the platform. Customer service, for example, author service, is done in all languages for both print and in digital. And my team has followed the author in every geography we've launched and made sure that the same team is cross-trained to be able to serve the authors. Another service that we've integrated already behind the scene is a service that ensures the quality and the legal rights of the book is satisfied. We call it content risk management. We check copyrights, local laws, quality, also we able to rate the book for adult handling across both platforms. Technology is also merged. We really need to merge the platform. And we have the blessing of two very successful businesses running in parallel. We don't want to disrupt them prematurely. And we want to do it when the right time comes. In fact, our vision is to have the author publish once and have their consumers read their book everywhere. And everywhere means three things for us. Number one is all geographies in all languages. So we want to help them translate their work in other languages. Hugh Howey is huge in other geographies. Number two, in all consumption devices. I don't think it's very clear to our consumers and our authors that you're not really tied to only Kindle. There are many, many smartphones and iPads and iPhones around the world than just Kindles. We would love for our readers to get the best value on Kindles, but their content is the whole ecosystem. And I don't think it's very obvious to the consumers and to the writers that their book is available in all format. In all consumption devices. So all geographies, all consumption devices. The third part is in all format. You asked the perfect question, which is, I've already given you the book, I've already given you the metadata, why do you ask me to log in again and give you the same credentials just because my audience prefers my book in a different format? This is our job to simplify, we're not there yet, and we want to do it with Kindle, through KDP, digital. We want to do it with print, using CreateSpace and print on demand, which is a very green way that we only printed because you've asked for it. And with our partners next door, we want to do the audiobook. ACX enables this marketplace to connect authors with their narrators, including their own voice, in an affordable way that makes audiobooks is also available. The fact that we also reward the consumers by giving an upgrade path from digital to audio, and also help them sync their work between written and audio, Whisper Sync for Voice, is brilliant. I think audience will have no excuse to stop reading or listening. The book keeps following them, whether they're reading it or they're in a bus and listening to it.
When you think of all the different ways you're making it easier to read and more convenient, it makes one feel optimistic about book reading. But when you talk to young people, they're playing video games, they're doing lots of things other than reading, especially a long book. Do you see that as the foe, is all the other things that take away from especially young people reading books?
I think it's one of our biggest challenges to teach the habit of reading, because reading has to be a form of entertainment, because it's competing with television, with internet, with Facebook. We have the same issue in Brazil. A huge population of the middle class are not reading. They are watching soap operas, they're watching soccer, and we need to get to them with content that is relevant to them. And that's what our authors have done in the US and very successfully. So I think content matters. You might want to start to think about their favorite soap opera derivative or their favorite soccer player to get them initially interested. You may think of shorter books like singles or serials. That gets longer form reading simpler. You might want to think about merging multimedia into the books to make it more appealing. So I think this is the best time to teach reading. I think this is the best time to invest in finding ways to make book reading as an entertainment. I think everybody loves to read, but they just don't know how to develop this habit. And we are in the perfect place with the Kindle Fire to bring all those multimedia elements into reading.
How do you see the role of the dedicated e-reader 5-10 years out, the e-ink Kindle, which is much better for reading text than all of the media? Do you expect that to kind of take a lesser and lesser proportion of the way we read long books?
I don't, actually. I feel very strongly that book lovers will always appreciate a dedicated device for reading. I love anecdotes that I heard from our CEO, which is, if you want to go to Africa for the safari, you don't take your smartphone to take pictures. You'll take a really dedicated camera. If you want to run the marathon, you just don't take any regular tennis shoes. You want to have a professional tennis shoes. So the people that love to read, we need to help them focus on reading. And the tablet is very distracting, to be honest with you. It brings some nice things about multimedia and color, which maybe the e-ink one day will catch up to that. But I love the fact that people are dedicated to reading on those devices, and you can read in bright sunlight, and now with the Paperwhite, you can read at night. So I'm torn. When my friends ask me, my child loves to read, what should I get them? I am favoring always the tablet, the e-book readers, the e-ink, because the tablet could be distracting.
You don't want your four-year-old to have a Twitter account.
That's true. Yes, I say, you know, if you can afford both, because they're affordable, get them both, because there's room for both. But if you love to teach or to embellish the habit of reading and develop it for your children, I think there is nothing better than the Kindle dedicated reader.
I've been speaking with Nader Kabbani, who is Vice President for Independent Publishing at Amazon. Thanks very much, Nader.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Turning now to content, I picked up lots of ideas of blogs about the Kindle and ebooks, and also some authors that I want to put on my to-read list at a roundtable that Amazon hosted at BEA last week. And I wasn't sure what this was about. I received an invitation and showed up at a room downstairs at the Javits Center, and it was a table set up in the round with Nader Kabbani and Libby Johnson McKee, who works with Nader at CreateSpace and Kindle Direct Publishing. And I'm going to tell you who was there, because I think these are all people that are doing interesting writing about ebooks and self-publishing primarily. And they're also connected with lots of ways that you can discover writers of note that could be of interest. And I'll have links to all of them at the show notes so that you can follow up on them. The authors included C.J. Lyons, L-Y-N-O-S, and she writes what she calls thrillers with heart, and she offered a simple formula for success in publishing. You write a great book, you give readers time to find it and recommend it, repeat. She was pretty funny. I really enjoyed hearing her talk about her experience as an author. And her latest book is Snakeskin, Book One of the Lucy Gardino FBI Thrillers. Hugh Howey was there. You heard him last week. If you heard the show, I did a brief interview with him. He's the author of Wool, and I find him a terrifically appealing author, and his story of how he, through self-publishing, ended up becoming a hybrid author, working with an agent here in Denver, is all pretty exciting. Also, there was Stephanie Bond, and her latest book, Two Guys Detective Agency, is available for pre-order with delivery on June 11th. Stephanie and CJ have both sold more than a million. They're one of the, I think there's seven authors who have sold a million copies on Kindle. And so Hugh was raising his hand in saying that he was looking forward to learning from them. He'll be a million seller soon. I think he was at 700,000 at BEA, and he autographed thousands of books, I think, at the booth that he shared with some other indie authors. The bloggers present included some who I had heard of and followed before, and some that I didn't know. Jane Friedman is someone who blogs at janefriedman.com, and she's the editor and editor at Virginia Quarterly Review. She's done a couple of really excellent webcasts that I've attended on self-publishing. There was also David Vandegrift at thepassivevoice.com. That's a blog about writers, writing, self-publishing, disruptive innovation, and the universe. Amy Edelman of indiereader.com spoke eloquently about essentially kind of rebranding the whole idea of self-published work as indie writers with the same cachet that independent filmmakers have and independent music makers, that it's in a transition toward standing for something that would be similar to those other art forms. She made a persuasive case and was interesting to hear. Also, Mercy Pilkington of goodereader.com, Jason Boog, editor of Gallycat. Gallycat describes itself as the first word on the book publishing industry. He's based in L.A. Porter Anderson blogs at porteranderson.com, and he wrote a terrific summary of the roundtable itself that I'll have a link to, and it was posted at janefriedman.com. And then also Jane Light of dearauthor.com, a romance review blog for readers by readers. So the discussion was kind of blue sky, what's ahead, what's happened. Each person had a chance to talk about their involvement in the space, and I found it a great discussion. And I also noticed that Nader and Libby were taking notes and really listening. This was a working session for them to learn things about what they might be doing next, and wasn't just kind of a PR session meant to generate copy among the blogs, but of course it did, and it was a pretty useful session. That's it for this week. My guest next week will be Tom Semple, a frequent contributor to the Kindle Chronicles with technical observations and help. He also is very active in other fine news sources about the Kindle and ebooks, from Kindle World to the ebook ninjas and beyond. So I think you'll enjoy talking to him. We're going to talk, I think, mainly about ways that the ebook platform can be improved. Our Kindle Chronicles Goodreads group continues to grow. We're up to 154 members. It'd be nice to get that up to 200 and then see where we go. Lots of good topics and comments that you've added. So if you haven't stopped by to check that out, I hope you will. The Kindle Chronicles group has a new topic I started a few weeks ago called Tech Support for Your Kindle. And there has been some activity there that's been useful. For example, Lauren posted a question about troubles she was having syncing her Audible.com content with her Kindle books, and there were helpful replies from Tom Semple and Goodreads member Geo Hube, H-U-E-B, who suggested always starting with the Audible book when you want to get an Audible book to sync with what you're reading on the Kindle. And Tom noted that sync can only work if each device has an internet connection at the end of each reading session. There are a few ways that you can support the podcast. If you're not familiar with them, if you go to thekindlechronicles.com, you will find a donate button that you can use if you'd like to make a one-time contribution toward the cost of doing the podcast. And below there is an Amazon link, which if you begin your shopping by clicking there, it could result in Amazon Associates commissions for me, and that would be much appreciated. There's also a subscribe button below the Amazon link, and you can use that if you'd like to sign up for a dollar a week contribution, which PayPal lets me set up as a subscription. Of course, the podcast is free, so this is an honorary subscription that helps out, and I'm very grateful to those of you who have been helping out doing this, some of you way back, and each week I see the contributions come in, and it's very encouraging to have folks who are making a regular contribution to help with the costs of putting the podcast on. Much appreciated. When I got back here to Denver after a month away, there was a satisfying stack of Kindles in my room here. I think there's probably about 20 behind me in boxes that have arrived. And these are used Kindles that I suspect many of you listening have sent. And I will be getting out I send receipt out that you can use for tax purposes, because these Kindle donations are tax deductible, because eBooks for Troops is a 501c3. And I also got word from a fellow that has been very supportive of eBooks for Troops, Dmitry Beryozkin, who I was going to try to see in New York, but we didn't quite make the connection. And he's sending 15 new Kindles to us that will be that also have arrived here. So I'll be shipping out some Kindles before we head back to Cambridge in July. If you're not familiar with the program, you'll find everything you need to know at ebooksfortroops.org. As I said, it's a 501c3 that I've started with Ken Clark, and Garrett Riley is now helping out with doing the communication with the military units overseas to make sure that we have shipping addresses, and he manages the queue of requests that we receive. It's a great program. You know, I thought about it. Yesterday was the anniversary of D-Day, and well, we've got a chance here to hear the clock strike the 8 o'clock hour, which means this show is going to bed well before midnight, which sometimes it does. But yeah, the D-Day anniversary. When I'm in touch with military personnel overseas through this program, an anniversary like that has particular impact, and so it's just been really rewarding work. And if you'd like to donate a used Kindle to us, or you can also contribute money to us that we use for buying accessories, but it's an all-volunteer organization, and we run pretty lean, but we get a lot of Kindles out the door to the troops. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't, and this version that I use in the podcast is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a jazz perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly in Denver, Colorado for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.